Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Pagans Tonight Radio Network, the voice of the pagan world. Pagans Tonight is sponsored by WitchSchool.com, your anyone, anytime, anywhere magical education.
Okay, I guess you know it'd be good if I actually had my notes up. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in today. You're listening to, I almost said the wrong show. You're listening to Walking the Unnamed Path, and I am Michael Graywolf, artist, traveler, all-around geek, and brother initiate of the Unnamed Path.
And I'm Matthew Sidney, songwriter, storyteller, and initiate, and now actually authorized instructor of the Unnamed Path. And you're listening to Walking the Unnamed Path. On this podcast, mm-hmm. we discuss the teachings and techniques given to us by the ancestors as laid out by Hyperion. We also touch on topics and ideas pertaining to queer pagan men in general. We're glad you've decided to join us, and we hope you'll be part of the show. If you're listening live, call us at 347-308-8222 and be part of the discussion. You can also hang out in the chat room if it's working. Is it working? Do you know if it's working, Michael?
I have a new computer after our last episode, luckily.
Yay!
And
new computer, yay!
Yay! But unfortunately, it doesn't have Flash installed, and it's a Mac, so I'm still getting used to all this. Like, I've been using a PC for so long, and I'm like, oh, it's like learning how to use a computer all over again. So I haven't installed Flash, and the chat room is actually a Flash thing, so I can't bring it up.
Got it. Sure. Well, maybe I'll despite my technical challenges, maybe I'll play around with it. And dear listeners, please drop us an email at walkingtheunnamedpath@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at walking_theup or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/walkingtheunnamedpath. So, Michael, how are you doing? I know you got a new computer.
Yes, that has been the highlight of the last few weeks, getting a new computer, and that's been kind of the only highlight. I've had a rough couple of weeks, unfortunately. I had a couple of friends pass away just a couple of weeks ago. I go to Pagan Spirit Gathering every summer, and two members of our community at Pagan Spirit Gathering unfortunately passed away. Both of them were kind of sudden. One of them died of complications she was having a heart surgery. And first round went okay, but then they had to go back and remove a blood clot. And unfortunately, she passed in the operating room. So that was kind of big hit to the community, because she has been she has led numerous rituals within our community, and she's an author, a professor, amazing woman, and she unfortunately passed. And then we had another member of the community who had been battling cancer for a little bit, and he was given 48 hours, but he was fighting and lasted to about the end of the week, but he passed also. So dealing with that and some other minor issues. But other than that, I'm ready for, a new week to start, and, I'm ready for today's episode. But, how have you been, Matthew? What have you been up to?
I'm doing well. And although my public persona is that I am a gentleman of independent means who spends his time composing fabulous musicals and writing the great American supernatural novel. I do, in fact, have a day job. And so I have been working a new gig here in San Diego. It's been wonderful, and I'm very grateful, great experience, great people. But naturally, it also takes up a lot of my time. I have a robust and healthy commute in the infamous Southern California traffic. So I get to spend a lot of time getting into heated discussions with my GPS, some of which are most colorful. So that's always fun. And a couple announcements that I wanted to make. One of our brothers in the Unnamed Path, Chase Powers, has announced that he is starting a new round of classes. So if any listeners are interested in finding out more, if any listeners are interested in taking the apprenticeship, it is a commitment of 1 year or more, you can look for Chase Powers on Facebook, or you can reach out to us, you can email us, or tweet at us,
I did share his post about it to our Facebook page.
Okay, good.
So
good.
It's out there.
Good. Yeah, and I believe he mentioned that he's planning to start classes March 3rd. So if anyone's interested, I would urge you to reach out to him as soon as possible. And then the second announcement that I want to make is Stone and Stang. Stone and Stang is a gathering for men who love men that is put together by the Brothers of the Unnamed Path every other year. And it is open to all men who love men. And I'm very excited because this year's theme is Into the Cauldron, Silence and Renewal. In these times of chaos and strife, we return to the cauldron of the goddess to incubate new wisdom and understanding within. Practices of silence create space for our spiritual gifts as men who love men. We come together to connect with each other, the land, ancestors, spirits of nature, and the gods. So Stone and Stang will occur on the weekend of it starts October 5th, 2018. It will be at Santa Cruz Mountains, California, and registration is open. So anyone who's interested, you can go right to stoneandstang.com. You can't miss it, stoneandstang.com. You can register this year. If you notice the registration, it may look like it's a little bit more money than it was last time, 2 years ago, but this time it includes food. Last time it did not. So last time the registration, and then there was sticker shock. Okay, now you got to fork over more money for food. But we still kept it very, very affordable, very affordable. So, I mean, for a whole weekend of, you know, room and board, I really, compared to other retreats that are out there, this can't be beat. And it's going to be really magical. I don't want to say too much about programming. I don't want to say too much about special speakers yet, because I don't want to count our chickens before they hatch. But I do believe we have one great speaker in particular lined up. And I know there's going to be some amazing amazing workshops. It looks like the emphasis is going to be on rolling up our sleeves and getting dirty. It's not going to be a whole lot of classwork type of activity. It's going to be more experiential, more ecstatic, more let's actually do the thing rather than just talking about it. So it's going to be spectacular.
Well, we'll definitely have to get one of our brothers who's on the planning committee on in the next month or so to talk to us a little bit more about Stone and Stang. But
yeah,
let's go ahead and introduce our guest, who is Sister Unity. Sister Unity is a drag nun since December 1995, is a founding member of the Los Angeles Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, Incorporated. In her 22 years in Bright Orange Habit, she has manifested in six states plus the District of Columbia. She has exercised and blessed the White House, the Lincoln Memorial, the National Office of AIDS Policy, and the Dolby Theater, home of the Oscars. She has performed several weddings, including one on the first day marriage became legal in California in June of 2008. She and the Los Angeles Sisters subsequently led many of the protests against Prop 8, against the Prop 8 ban on gay marriage until it was overturned. She has performed and lectured at UCLA, La Jolla, Marymount, Occidental and Wesleyan University, and gave the keynote address at the 2017 Fall Gay Men's Spirit Visions Retreat in North Carolina, which Matthew went to. Her 10 years of YouTube contributions feature 80 videos with content including Hindu mythology, LGBT fairy tales, humor, philosophy, spirituality, and LGBT rights and activism. Sister Unity has practiced Hinduism and meditation since before becoming a drag nun and derives her name from Sanskrit. So let's go ahead and bring on Sister Unity. Hello.
Hello, ladies. Oh. I told you I brought sound effects.
Oh, my.
Love it. That was my third rubber chicken. I have a rubber chicken collection. That one is a rubber chicken dressed like a pirate with a little T-shirt that says, I heart booty.
Oh. You really go through them chickens.
Well, you know, in Los Angeles, there are just so many chickens to choose from. I'm a nun. I'm here to serve. I'm here to serve chicken, frankly.
Sister Unity, what can
you
tell
us about I'm going to do you a favor.
Yes.
I was speaking in my last meditation. I was speaking with the unnamed path, and she wants to be called Francine. So the path is now Francine. Hello and welcome, everyone, to Francine, the path.
Walking the Francine, walking on Francine. I hear that's good for your back.
Or prancing on Francine. Mincing the unnamed path. Sauntering the
there
unnamed path. Just a suggestion. So may I take your order?
Will you tell us about your name? Why Unity?
When we started the Los Angeles Sisters, originally the idea to start a group down here was in the brain of Sister Candy, who grew up in Pasadena. And she had gone up to San Francisco, and I had actually gone to San Francisco in 1982 and seen the sisters there. I just sort of wandered down the street one day visiting my sister, and there was this crowd, and I was like, what the hell is this? And there was the Gay Pride Parade, and it was the first time I'd ever heard of a Gay Pride Parade, and that blew my lid off. And there were, like, gay Samoans, and I was like, oh, my God, we have gay Samoans? And then there were gay Native Americans. And I was like, oh, my God, that's so cool. And then there were gay dads, and I was like, you can do that? And then, you know, I was an impressionable teenager. And then the sisters rolled by with one of the most famous and historic sisters, Sister Boom Boom, was in the back of a convertible like all the politicians in the parades. And she had a huge dildo, and she was flailing it at the crowd like she was blessing them with it. And that just flipped my lid, and I was electrified by the combination of activism, the sort of flipping off the institutions that oppress us by adopting them and turning them into sarcastic gay humor, the iconoclasm, and the silliness and fun and color and sarcasm, all real, and the theatricality all really appealed to me. So I had met them then, and Sister Candy had met them in the early 90s, and she came back to L.A., and she said, got together some people that she knew, and she had known me from some theatrical work and a few drag, charitable drag runway shows. And she asked me if I'd be interested in joining, and you know, I was like, oh, let's see, be life of the party and for a good cause that advances gay rights, duh. And originally when I started, my name, I used my radical fairy name, and I was Sister Shiva Tapioca, wet nurse to the infant of Prague. But my fairy identity was pretty strong in those days, and I wanted to distinguish my sister persona from my fairy persona. And I had been practicing meditation. I've been a practitioner of a path called Siddha Yoga since 1989. And my meditation master had given me a spiritual name in 91, the Sanskrit word for unity. I thought if I used the English translation, Sister Unity was a kind of fundamental and kind of hip concept, if you will. But also, I wanted to bring the experience I had of Dharma, of being grounded, of something higher and deeper to my work as a sister, being very conscious of the archetype and the actual history of cross-gendered gay men who in every society in early pre-Christian culture, we were the spiritual functionaries in one way or another of every society found on the face of the earth. I had to research this when Paramount was putting out a DVD for Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. They hired me to write Easter egg content on the history of drag. And my research uncovered all of this that I hadn't known before. There's an amazing book, if you can get a copy, usually you can get one on eBay, called The Other Face of Love. And it was written in France in 1964, but the English translations are widely available. And a lot of this information is in that book. And then there's been dozens and dozens. I mean, academia is just sort of jacking itself all off about gay history and queer history. So the information is now out there. But it was in those days in the early 90s, it was a stunning revelation that we were everywhere. And not only that we existed, but that we had a revered position in society, and one that I think is frankly built into the way that nature is constructed. So I took that name, conscious of all of that implication, and at least for me, to bring that when I was going out in public. So I sort of had this sense of what I had to bring to people. And then I just went out and acted silly. One of the names I thought of calling myself was Sister Starburst Fruit Chew. And in many ways, I regret not choosing it.
Now, have you read Two Flutes Playing by Andrew Raymer? Because that book touches on a lot of what you're talking about, mm-hmm. about our spiritual role in society.
Mm. I'm very familiar with the book, but you know what? I'm so sorry to say I did not actually read it all the way through because, frankly, I would rather a trombone. It's a little more my size. Particularly if it's rusty.
It can be a challenging read.
Yeah.
Sister, could you tell us a little bit about, who are the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence? I know I myself...
I have no idea, but they won't let me out of this cellar. Help!
you first saw them at a Pride Parade. I remember being really when I first came to the gay bar, seeing the nuns with beards, and it's like, who are these people? Because I was so used to seeing the drag queens at the Rose Room, which is our drag venue here in Dallas, and very much looking like as female as they could be. And I know some of the sisters do that also, but you're so well known for being the bearded nun also.
It's true, we are. And there's a really important point to that and to genderfuck as a genre in total. And it is a reminder that there's male and there's female, and that drag and that otherness and creativity and queerness is not necessarily just men being women, but that there is a whole other way, a whole other mode of presentation, behavior, and existence. And a feminine with a masculine mixed together, a nun with a beard, those are very two powerful signifiers in our sort of social ontology of gender. So very proudly we mix them together as if to say, you're going to have to let go of your preconceptions and your concepts, and you're going to have to accept that there is something that is just queer, weird, out of the ordinary, creative and different, and that doesn't fit into slots, that openly and purposefully defies slots, and you can take that in a Freudian sense if you wish, But you know what I mean? It, as they say in yoga and a lot of the other spiritual paths, if you're going to attain the transcendent, you're going to have to break all of your concepts. And this is certainly a call to society to break the concept of gender and putting people in boxes in gender signifiers and identity. The sisters started with this sort of joke. It was three guys in Iowa, and they went to a convent. They were doing a part of a theater troupe called the Sugar Plum Fairies, and they were doing an all-male production of The Sound of Music. And they went to this convent to borrow some habits to use, and they didn't tell them it was all male. And the nuns gave them these actual deceased nuns' habits that had been worn by real nuns. The Kenneth Bunch, who was Sister Adanareshvara, okay, I've gotten it completely mangled. He had a long Sanskrit name when he began, but he became Sister Vicious Power Hungry Bitch. And now recently he's changed it to Sister Vishnos. And he was one of the one of those three that started it all off. They moved to San Francisco from Iowa, and on the day before Easter in 1979, they put on these habits and they went out on the town. And they went all over the place, to the beach and to the Castor and all over. And they got such a huge reaction from people. They realized that they had really grabbed onto an archetype that was resonant and hilarious and usable. So they regrouped and they got, I think, a little more than 12 people together. And Sister Missionary Position, also one of the founders who had been a Catholic seminarian, came up with the name, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. And they went about promulgating this, perpetrating this charade of joy and mission work. As the original statement of the sisters says, we exist to promulgate, to expiate stigmatic guilt and promulgate universal joy. And that's really the whole secret to it, and has been ever since, is using that sarcastic iconoclast humor joyfully to break people's concepts, liberate people, be the voice for those who have no voice, like the jester who is not afraid to point out that the emperor has no clothes, and to make people smile and laugh and feel better about themselves, whether they're queer or trans or bi or lesbian or gay or asexual or intersexual or fructose sexual or weasel sexual, as I myself prefer. And it's been that way ever since. And then we do charitable fundraising, and that started in the early 80s when the AIDS crisis hit. The sisters were the hosts of the very first candlelight vigil for AIDS in San Francisco. We put out one of the world's first safe sex pamphlets called Playfair, and started pitching in and doing sort of silly shows to raise money for these burgeoning AIDS service organizations, because as any of your listeners who were alive and you know, old enough to remember back in that day, there wasn't anyone doing anything to help us with in the gay community with AIDS. The government wasn't helping. The state government wasn't helping. It was awful. It was all up to us in the beginning. And the sisters dove right in and pitched in. And so charitable fundraising, not just for HIV/AIDS, but also for homeless LGBT youth, which is a huge, huge problem that is completely unrecognized by broader society, but is, well, here's an example. In Los Angeles alone, on any given night, there's between 5 and 15,000 homeless teenagers and kids thrown out by their families or having to run away to escape violence. 40% to 50% of them self-identify as LGBT, and that's just the ones who admit it. We feel that the numbers are higher. So no one's taking care of these kids. There's a handful of service organizations, and they need help, so we pitch in with that. And the sisters have grown now from those early days in San Francisco, and we were the third house in the U.S. after Seattle, and we were the sixth house in the world after San Francisco, Sydney, Australia, Seattle, Paris, and Berlin, and then we came along. Now there's 45 houses of sisters in North America, U.S. and Canada, and 11 countries around the world, including Uruguay.
Wow. Wow. That is amazing.
So, you know, you can get laid by a nun in 11 countries.
Wonderful. So I'm going to jump around a little bit. So the sisters, there's an emphasis on humor, and I'm sensing what I like to call the function of the sacred clown. And
yes,
you know, here in the Unnamed Path, you know, we study shamanism, and we tend to style ourselves as very serious conjurers and very serious workers with spirits, but I think that theater and humor are intrinsically magical and do have a powerful role to play. And through your YouTube channel and also seeing you in person, I'm most impressed by the power of your storytelling. To me, your storytelling is truly magical and transformative. How did you develop that? How did you discover that gift?
I decided to try mushrooms as an anal suppository, and that really opened the door to storytelling.
I jest.
For the record, just for the record, I do not use mind altering substances. I don't really drink, and I've only smoked half a joint with an actual person from Bohemia once in the early 90s. I've just never been interested in using mind altering substances. For some people, they really break the mold and open up new worlds and new concepts, and that's really important. They have a shamanic use, certainly. I just prefer to be weird on my own. I believe in the power of art and the power of meditation, but that's me. What do I know? I'm an orange Hindu drag nun. But the storytelling came around. I had been a theater major in college. And I studied theater at Wesleyan University, and of course, as my bio on the LA Sisters website, lasisters.org, will tell you, I went to Harvard for a degree in biofungal commerce. Out of my theater training, I don't know why or how, but I went back to my home state of Maine the year after college, and sort of flopped around, worked at a couple of theaters there for a year before I moved to L.A. But while I was out there, I just got this bee in my bonnet, and I started to make up stories, just improvise them off the top of my head. And I'd be driving in the car, which if you know Maine at all, you go for hours between, you know, cornfields and pine trees and nothing to do and look at. And so you pass the time by, you know, farting and laughing and farting the national anthem. So I just made up stories with my friends in the car, and that segued over the years into actually writing. When I moved to LA, I started to write them down. And it's been my hobby, not as a sister, just been my hobby writing fairy tales. And then when I started this YouTube thing, I bought a Mac in 2007 because it had a built-in camera and sound and editing software. And I was like, oh, great, I'll do Unity videos. No idea what I'll do. And I just started. If you look at the early ones, there's no sound because I had no idea what to say. So I was like experimenting with the medium and seeing what, you know, throwing the clay on the wheel, trying not to get my apron all messy. And then the first video I made with sound was the story of Ganesh, who is the Lord of New Beginnings. So I thought, well, that's an auspicious start to using language, the Lord of Beginnings. And it came out better than I thought it would. And I thought, wow, that's a really cool medium, this YouTube. Wow, the internet's right, kind of neat. So I started to do a cross between telling with a serious tone the Hindu myths that I found delightful, intriguing, and sometimes revolutionary, such as the story of the birth of the god Skanda. He's the god of war. He's the son of Shiva. But his birth is ribald and fecund and sexual. Basically, Shiva has just married Parvati, and he's fucking her brains out. And they are pounding away so hard that it is shaking creation apart. The three worlds are in danger of being destroyed. And so all the gods get together, and they go like, okay, we've got to stop them from screwing. It's going to, you know, ruin existence. And they get Agni, the god of fire, to go and disguise himself, as he has the power to do, as a wandering holy man, a swami. And because the swamis wear flame-colored robes. And so he goes as this disguise to Shiva's house on Mount Kailas. And in India, when a holy man comes to your home, you are morally obligated to stop what you're doing and give them food or money or something. So he shows up, and Parvati is like, Shiva, there's a holy man. We have to stop. We have to give him some alms. And Shiva's like, I was just about to come. And he's furious. And he sees right through Agni's disguise, and he's like, oh, okay, you want alms? Here's your alms. Since you earned it, now you take care of it. And he sticks his dick in Agni's mouth and finishes coming. And because Agni is the god of the sacred fire, he distributes all that is offered to him to all of the gods. And so all of Shiva's semen goes from Agni into the stomachs of all of the gods. And Shiva is the meditating god, and his spiritual power is so blindingly strong that his semen burns white hot, and it burns the gods in their tummies, and they have to run to Vishnu and be like, Shiva's semen is burning us. What do we do? And then Vishnu's like, he laughs at them, and he's like, don't ask me. It's not my semen. Go ask Shiva. So they go to Shiva, and they're like, what do we do? And Shiva's like, dude, throw it up. And so all of the gods of Hinduism barf Shiva's semen into a giant pile as big as a mountain. And then the story goes on from there. But, you know, that is straight out of the Skanda Puranas, one of the classic scriptural texts of Hinduism. And I got it from a copy that I bought, a translation done earlier in the 20th century that I got from the Vedanta Society bookstore at the Vedanta Center here in Los Angeles. So it's like straight up. It is not one of those bolderized versions from someone who was like, I'm going to turn this into a gay revolution. It was actually that gay, written 5 to 10,000 years ago. So I feel that knowing that and hearing that is really important. How many people, how many of us when we're young and gay would have loved hearing that one of the five major religions and the oldest one in the world and the third most popular religion in the world has woven into it that kind of sexuality? That's really important. So I tell those stories.
Yeah.
Then the other ones are just fucking around. Like some of the ones I fuck around with Grimm's fairy tales just because, and then some of the others that I write myself are particularly fairy tales for gay people about gay people in the symbolic vernacular or vocabulary of Tolkien, Grimm's fairy tales.
Ooh.
There's
yeah,
one. I wrote one called. What's that?
I was just going to ask, do you have a favorite one of the gay fairy tales that you've written?
Yes, my absolute favorite, and this is an example of writing a fairy tale for the gay community. It's called The Town, the Wolves, and the Witch, or The Town, the Witch, and the Wolves. That's it. The Town, the Witch, and the Wolves. And I wrote that one on the day that Prop 8 first became legal. Gay marriage first became legal before Prop 8 in June of 2008. I had gotten in face, which is what we call dressing up as a sister. I'd gotten in face and went with Sister Margaret Snatcher down to West Hollywood Park, where the city had set up tents to perform marriages. And in the community center there, they had the licensing. So people were like in line way up the street, up San Vicente Boulevard, waiting to get their licenses, the marriage licenses. And then they would go, and if they wanted, they could have a wedding performed out back. And I'm a licensed minister with the Universal Life Church of Modesto, California. Thank you very much. Aren't we all? And I went to serve my constituents, to encourage them to be part of the day, to add the energy, to bring the queer, and to perform any weddings that anyone might want performed. In fact, a couple that had me perform a wedding before it was legal, just as a spiritual event, where they are getting their license, and they asked me to do it again for them. And you can actually, we came over to my apartment after, and they made a video, and that's one of the videos. You can actually see their wedding on YouTube. But while I was there, three gay people, two gay men and a lesbian woman, one of the gay men, an organizer of the event, ridiculed me for being in drag there that day. One of them, I was giving an interview to Korean television, and he leaned in, sort of photobombed and leaned into the shot and was like, oh, fine, great, you're really helping our chances in November. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for ruining it. And I was just stunned. The sisters don't usually get that kind of criticism. Well, in Los Angeles, which is a pretty gay city, we don't. So I was really stunned by that, and I didn't think on a dime. But then later, out by where the weddings were happening, a gay guy who is holding a mic on a boom for a documentary maker turns around to me and he goes, you know, love the sisters, totally get it, totally get the message, love it, just not here, not today, no, no. And then the lesbian woman who's helping him turns around and goes, yeah, I got to agree. And I was really furious about that. And my response was, oh, I'm sorry, am I too gay for you? When were you planning on telling people that some of us don't conform to pants and blue jeans and T-shirts? Were you just going to hide us in a closet so that you could get by with your cock-sucking at home only? or were you going to let them know that some of us like glitter? So I went home, and I sat in front of my computer, and I made this long diatribe talk video, and it was dry, and I was up in my head, and I trust my intuition on these things, and my intuition said, no, scrap that. And I thought, well, what do I do? How do I address this? And my intuition said, tell a story. So the video you see is either the first or second take. I only did, I did two takes, bam, straight out. The story came out exactly as you see it. I did a second take only because I flubbed a couple of words in one of them. And it just came, it poured out. And when you're really close to your feelings and close to your heart and close to your intuition, storytelling or whatever your craft is, sometimes you just get these lucky bluebirds from heaven that just, it comes out in one piece and it says itself. I'm privileged to have been able to move my lips to help it, but it made itself. And that story expresses exactly what I wanted to say to those three people who ridiculed me for being a sister on the day that a spiritual function like marriage was first allowed legally by our society.
What was the name of that story again?
The Town, the Witch, and the Wolves. It's a story of a town that is served by a witch for many years, and then a priest comes to the town and convinces everyone to forego the witch and turn their backs on the witch and her gifts in favor of getting money and fancy things from the church, and that what happens and how the town responds and what happens to the town.
I just found the YouTube link, and I just posted it to the Walking the Unnamed Path site so that
I'm sorry,
followers
you mean you posted it to Francine?
Can share it.
I posted it to Francine.
Very good. I'm sure she's very happy with it, I hope.
You know, we have... I'm looking. The video itself is about 8.5 minutes. Do we have time for you to tell us the story?
You mean live?
Yeah. Or am I?
I'd be happy to. If you can mark the time for me, and make sure I do not, ruin your schedule. I'd hate for the next, Wall Street Week in Review program after you, or, How to Bake Queer Muffins or whatever comes after you. I'd hate to interrupt their time period.
Yeah. I think Terry Gross can wait.
So
let's go for it.
You know what? I'm going to stay on and make her over, and she will be Terry City after this.
Good.
I wouldn't dream of interrupting Terry Gross. What she does is vitally important these days.
I'll tell you the story.
Once upon a time, there was a painful hemorrhoid named Richard. And Richard had been vice president, and he decided to run for president. But there were these other hemorrhoids called Kennedys. Oh, I'm sorry. That's the wrong story. That's entirely the wrong story. I'm so sorry. I was opening my American history note. The cat's out of the bag. We can reveal to you now that America has been run by hemorrhoids ever since Dwight Eisenhower left office. So sorry, everyone. Once there was a town. And this town had a little hill behind it. And in the cave in that hill lived a witch. And this witch would help the mothers of the town when, in the dead of winter, their children would catch cold or be colicky. She would boil some pine needles, or she would boil some nettles, and she would chant a few phrases over the pot and put in some honey from beehives that grew in the forests. And she would give the elixir to the mothers to give to their children, and the children would be well. And in the dead of winter, when the wolves were at their hungriest, she would walk a circle about the town using her little silver sickle-shaped knife to carve markings in the trunks of the trees and on the ground to let the wolves know that this town was protected by a watchful, powerful presence, and not to come around looking to eat the livestock of the town. And the wolves obeyed and kept away. And in this way, the witch kept the town well and safe. Well, one day, a priest came to this small, off-the-beaten-track town. And this priest, from an unnamed denomination of some sort of religion, which I won't speak of, he stopped in the town and he said, "Oh, look at this lovely little town with these charming little people. They don't have a church." And he went in the town square and he started to stop people and talk to them and say, "You don't have a church. How do you worship? You don't have a church." And he convinced the town people. He gathered them all into a town meeting and he stood up and he spoke and he said, "Townspeople, if you will build a church, I, who have a direct link to the Pope of my religion, will get this Pope to come to your town, and he will bring all the gifts of the church. He will bring you the incense and the candles for the church and rich tapestries, and he will bring you the gold of the church. Ooh! And you might even have a little extra gold after you build the church to buy new shoes and fancy pocketbooks." And the townspeople thought, well, this church gig was a pretty cool thing. So they went around building and starting and gathering the stones to build it, because it was going to be a little post-Tudor stone Episcopalian-looking thing, except it's not Episcopalian because I'm not talking about which denomination this is. But they had a pope. And one day the priest saw some of the women leaving the construction of the church with little satchels filled with flowers. And she said, "Where are you all going?" And they said, "Oh, we're going to take these flowers up to the witch's cave. She has promised to make a garland to welcome the energy and the spirits of your religion into this holy church." And the priest turned white. I mean, whiter than he already was, which I think we can assume from his sort of ethnocentrism here. And he turned white and he said, "A witch? Oh, no, no. There cannot be a church in a town with a witch. Oh, no, no. My religion does not truck with witches. The Pope will not come. If there is a witch in this town, there will be no visit. There will be no gold of the church, no fancy tapestries, and no shoes and fancy pocketbooks. I can tell you that." And the burgomasters calmed him down and said, "We will have a word with the witch about not being a witch." And so the burgomasters went up to the witch's cave. And they sat down with her as she served them her rosemary tea, which is good for curing depression. And they said, "So this church we have." And she said, "Yes, congratulations, it looks lovely." And they said, "The thing is, it won't happen if, well, you see, the witch is quite against their rules, and so we were wondering if maybe while this church thing were happening, if you might just not be around much." And the witch looked them in the eye, and she saw in their faces exactly what was going on, and knew exactly what they wanted, and what they felt, and what they weren't saying. And without torturing them anymore and making them explain themselves, she nodded her head silently and then bid them adieu. And the burgomasters went back to the town quite relieved. But after they had left, the witch covered over the path to her cave with bougainvillea branches and bittersweet vines, and she mumbled a few words that made them grow thick, and made the thickness grow in people of the town's memories, so that everyone forgot the way to the witch's cave. Well, the church was built, and the Pope came, and everyone was delighted, because he was very famous, and there was the gold of the church, and the tapestries, and the incense was so delightful. It was some sort of sandalwood mixed with the rose, mixed with some sort of flower no one had heard of. And the new shoes were quite comfortable. But the winter came, and the babies got sick. And the women thought, you know, there used to be this person, someone was able to cure this, and I just can't remember where they are. And the women lost sleep and became haggard because the babies kept them up at night with their colicky crying. And then, deep in the coldest part of the winter, when everything was frozen over and there was little food, the wolves came back. And first, it was the sheep out in the pastures on the edge of town, nuzzling through the snow to find clumps of dried brown grass to eat, and the wolves could take them easily. And then it was the chickens all boxed up in their little Happy Meal coops for the wolves. But then it was the cattle, and even the horses. And one night, a wolf was seen scratching at the window of one of the children, the bedrooms of one of the children of the town. And so all the townspeople came together. Their livestock were thinning and almost gone. The danger was very present, and they said, "We are unprotected, and we must do something about these wolves." And the burgomasters looked at each other and said, "You know, it would have been good to keep at least the address of the witch." And then they turned to the priest, and they said, "You, you're the interlocutor with the miraculous deity thing you have in your church. Make him help us with these wolves." And the priest said, yes, I will pray. Let us all bow our heads and we will pray, for that is the great power that we are given by our deity. We will pray that it may be in their grand design that it not be fated for the wolves to eat us. That's what we will pray." And the burgomasters looked at each other and said, "I don't think so." And one of them whispered to the others, "I have a plan. Let's take the priest to the outskirts of town and watch him deal with the wolves himself." And so that night they brought the priest to the edge of the town, and they tied him to a stick and left him there and went back into the town. And at night the wolves came around and they ate the priest. And he was very tasty. And later that night, and for the next 7 days and nights, the wolves ate all of the townspeople. And they were quite tasty. Well, the spring came, and the witch came out of her cave, and she looked down upon the town and saw that it was uninhabited. So she packed up her things, and she moved round the end of the range of hills, which hers had been the last. And she found a town at the other end, and a cave above that town, and she moved in. And the townspeople there were very happy to have her, for they knew that the witch brought her tea of nettles and pine needles that cured babies' colds. They knew she could cure colic, and they knew she had a silver sickle-shaped knife. And they knew that having a witch was a great boon. They were wise enough to know that everyone has some gift to offer the community for its own good. The end.
I love that story. I love that story so much.
I'm very pleased with that story. I'm very, very happy that it decided to make itself through me.
Yeah. And it's obviously so relevant today. How did you discover Hinduism?
I was having a steak one night, and just as I poked my fork in, it was rare, and the cow was, it just went ow. My steak was like ow, excuse me, and whipped out a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, and that was that. No, I'm just kidding, because, of course, the Bhagavad Gita is Krishna telling Arjuna how to kill his family. It's interesting. I grew up in New England as an atheist, a devout atheist. My father was a religiously atheist. And in ninth grade, I had sort of been discussing Bertrand Russell and knew that we had created God in our own image and, you know, there was no God and why we had created God and all of this, and went skipping along my path merrily through college. And then at one of those theaters in Maine that I was interning at, there was this woman in the front office, in the ticket-taking office, and she and I made friends and started to discuss comparative religion and mythology. And we would sit down in libraries and compare sequences of sevens and twelves in various astrological and religious discourses, we kept finding repeating patterns. We would find that astrological signs would correspond with Greek gods, which would correspond with Hindu gods, which would correspond with colors. And we'd find all of these matching patterns. And we graphed them. Somehow we came up with a system to put them on a graph. And when we plotted the graph, it formed a double helix. And I was blown away by that. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, totally. And I was like, yeah. So I didn't know what was going on, but I knew something was going on. I just had no idea what. Then I moved to Los Angeles, and I got a brilliant edition of the Tao Te Ching, one of the ones by, you know, that group of guys who were translating all of the Sufi poets. Here it is. Stephen Mitchell's Tao Te Ching. He's one of the party with Daniel Ledinsky translating Rumi and Hafiz. And it's very alive, very juicy, very contemporary vernacular. So I read it, and it was the first time I'd conceived of there being some notion of a transcendent reality that wasn't a guy with a beard telling you what to do. And I was like, wow, okay, I could get behind that. So I was in this state, which we would now recognize as the liminal state, the in-between state. I called it the I don't know. Being in a place where you don't know, I think, is absolutely important and vital for spiritual pursuits, because you're open, you are ready. As Hamlet says, the readiness is all. And in that state, my neighbor, who had been practicing this particular meditation path, asked me if I was interested in going to this meditation center. And I loved Indian culture. I used to burst into tears at college when I would go to a Bharatanatyam dance concert. Or if they, you know, they played gamelan or played South Indian music, I would just burst into tears with joy. So I was like, oh, yeah, I'm all up for that. Let's go. And I'm sitting on this floor, a carpeted floor in this darkened meditation center with these cute guys and chanting in Sanskrit. And I'm like, oh, how many of my friends in New York are chanting in Sanskrit? Ooh. So, you know, it was like chic at first. And my sense of iconoclasm was like, I worship a guy with an elephant's head. Ooh. But soon, and I said to myself, oh, these things never last with me. I'll just take this as far as it goes. But 9 months later, I was on a plane to India. Because over the 3 months, the first 3 months that I was actually going to this center and chanting, and I could only meditate for like 3 minutes at a time, they said two things that hooked me in, or that opened the door, that allowed me to take this up. One was, this is your path. Take what works for you and leave what doesn't. We're going to offer it all. You just take what works for you and use it. See where it goes. It's a lab. Experiment. And I thought, okay, that's my kind of, you know, spiritual path or religion. And then the other thing was the mantra that they use, the meaning of it is that non-dual, that beautiful school of Hinduism, Kashmir Shaivism, which even more than Vedanta is non-dualist. Na shivam vidyate kwachit is my favorite Sanskrit quotation. It means there is nothing that is not Shiva. Shiva being the name of the god, but being a stand-in for that concept of the oneness, the absolute that is all, that is your own inner self, which is the self of everything, the self of the universe, the self of this phone, the self of my shits in the morning, the self of flowers, the self of my mother. You know, it's all one. And this mantra meant I bow to that oneness, that self, that is my own self, pointing both to the universality and to the fact that it's in you, and you can experience the universal in the local, in your own self, if you shut up and sit down and go pay attention to it, you know, let it come up in your awareness. So that philosophy, that take on this notion of the divine or the transcendent really appealed to me. And so then I just started to experiment, and damned if experiences of Shakti and little lights in meditation didn't happen over time. And I was like, holy crap, there's something to all this. So that's what I do. I sit down and sort of see what happens inside and see what I can discover, or even just to chill out. It brings me back to... A lot of people talk about spirituality in terms of like bliss and like, oh, I feel the oneness. I've never had that. For me, it's the clarity, like a mountain stream where the water is about 2 feet deep and you can see the rocks in the bottom as though there were no water at all. That's what I get from Hinduism, from meditation, from these spiritual practices, that clarity. And I will tell you, that comes in handy as a sister.
And, you know, that leads us to my next question. How has, or has it even...
7 inches.
Your journey... You're higher. How has your journey as a sister informed your spiritual life?
Absolutely has been the case in point of my spiritual life. In my spiritual path, there's a practice called seva, which means selfless service. Another phrase for it is karma yoga. If you serve in a place that is devoted to the divine or is filled with a lot of shakti, and you do service in that place, that performing that act is a spiritual practice. I used to clean the bathrooms at our meditation center, and I swear to you, it washed away a lot of my anxiety. I don't know how it works. It's a metaphysical thing. Maybe it doesn't happen for other people, but it certainly happened. It happened for me. And that now I perform a selfless service where the organization of the path I study offers a correspondence course to people who are incarcerated, and then they write in letters, and so I'm a volunteer respondent to their letters. And it's like every time I get one to respond to, it's like a pressure builds until I finish my homework of writing the response. It's like popping a zit. So I'm spiritually popping zits. It's kind of like spiritual acne. So the way that all of that understanding informs being a sister is that I look at what we do as a form of the same thing, like responding to the letters. Here's an example. The first night I manifested as Sister Unity with god-awful makeup, it was for Mardi Gras in 1996. And we went to West Hollywood. They used to close off the alleyway behind the bars, and they'd have, you know, beer tables, and guys would be around showing their dicks and getting beads and la la la. So I go wading into the crowd, and in my mind I'm like, okay, do I play a character? Is this a character, or do I be me? Like, what is it? And at first I was like being a character and being all like, hi, my name's Sister Unity. Here's my squeaky penis. But then I saw this guy. This tall, dark, heavyset guy, and he looked like crap. He looked so depressed. And I walked up to him, and I said, hey, you're not smiling. What's going on? And he told me his story about dealing with depression, and he was out of work, and nothing was going right, and he didn't have a boyfriend, and he didn't feel attractive. And that's when I drew on the things that I had learned from my spiritual practices and a little from doing work in therapy, and I used to work in a counseling center. So just throwing a few basic psychology ideas. But a lot of it came from this notion of spend time with yourself. Be still, be quiet, return to yourself, and find out what's inside of your heart. And I was telling him this thing and telling him to love himself. And it is bizarre to me. But so few people in our culture are told that or understand that. We don't teach each other. We don't teach our children to spend time with yourself and to love yourself the way you would love a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a son, or a daughter. This whole notion of caring for yourself, doing for yourself, honoring yourself, pampering yourself. I mean, we indulge ourselves, but we don't pamper ourselves in like this loving, uplifting way, like you would if, you know, you'd bring chicken soup to someone who was sick or you loved. You'd bring them little chocolates on Valentine's Day. Do these things for yourself, my God. You deserve it. You're your first boyfriend. So I told him
that's
all this.
Right. I deserve that dark chocolate.
Oh, you deserve more than that. You come over. You come to the convent, cell number 138, after 10 p.m. You will get chocolates, but you're not going to eat them with your mouth. I'm just telling you. So that led me to, like, I had to be my true self, not a character, and I had to come from my own spiritual experience to do that. And then it comes back to you because 6 months later, I saw the guy on the street, and he was like, "Oh, sister, you really helped me." And I was like, "What?" And he told me that he started to practice what I had told him. and his life had turned right around. He had found a job. He had found a boyfriend. He was clearly happy. He was beaming. So I was flabbergasted. I was like, oh my God, this shit works. But it's still, it's uncanny how the basic spiritual truths that I was able to, that I'm lucky enough to have been told myself by others, the grace others have given me, that I had a context in which to pass them on. The YouTube videos are, that's why I wanted to make them too. It's like, I'm like, holy shit, these things that people have given me are so useful. I've got to pass them on. So YouTube and being a sister are contexts in, they're vehicles of delivery, if you will. And the sisters are really conscious about that. We're very conscious about being the cross-gendered shaman archetype, the sacred fool, sacred clown. But also, we call it doing mission work. Very conscious that it's not just all show, that we do, while we're out in the bars, stop and talk to people and listen to them and just give them words of joy, of love, of encouragement, that is a moral act, a political act, and a spiritual act. And we believe wholeheartedly in doing that.
Amen.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, women. Hey, whatever.
You know, the time has flown by, and I thank you so much for sharing this time with us. Do you have anything that you want to announce, any events coming up, or any messages that you want to share with our listeners?
If you're visiting the Los Angeles area, write for tickets to our – I'm sorry, that's a game show. If you are in Los Angeles, I do offer anal massage. I'm just saying, just in passing, cell number 138 at the convent. But also, if you're coming to Los Angeles for DragCon, we will have a booth. We are likely to have a panel, a speaking panel as well, and we would love to see you. So you can find me, Sister Unity, on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. I feel free to message on Facebook. I answer those messages pretty readily. And you're welcome to ask questions or say hello, whatever you'd like. I attend to all of my social media because I am, after all, a lonely bastard who sits at home on Saturday nights masturbating and looking at social media.
Now, there's some hot social media, so it's understandable.
As many of us do.
May the power of the rubber chicken bless your nipples.
Ooh, I felt that.
I want to thank you two very, very much for inviting me to speak on your show. I don't usually get asked questions that relate what the sisters do with spirituality. Most people see us for the comedy and the joy, but don't relate it to spiritual practice and understanding directly. So I'm very, very pleased to have been asked to answer your questions.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, thank you for coming on. Yeah.
And I also want to say a thank you to our listeners for tuning in. And until next time, be blessed and love yourself and make love to yourself. And remember that you are a part of the healing, and your healing is an essential part of the equation.
Yes. And I'm going to go ahead and play us out with a song. This is from S.J. Tucker. This is the In Bulk song, which just premiered on Pagan Tonight Radio this past Wednesday. So,
yay!
Play that. Yeah.
Just around the corner, nobody knows. 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 Which has trust your intuition, you never know what will come. If you believe in divination, follow the signs straight away home. For the milk upon the ground, hail the winter winding down, and walk your come. If you believe in divination, follow what it finds, straight away home, pour the milk upon the ground. Hey, but in winter, winding down, and walk your path with both eyes open, which is trust your intuition. You never know what will come. If you believe in divination, follow the signs, straight away home, pour the milk upon the ground. Pale the winter, winding down, and walk your path with folded eyes open, which is trust your intuition. If you believe in divination, follow the signs, straight away home, pour the milk across the ground. Pale the winter, winding down, and walking through the path with both eyes open. Blessings of God.
Again, that was S.J. Tucker, Imbolc Song. Again, you have been listening to Walking the Unnamed Path. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for future shows, please feel free to email us at walkingtheunnamedpath@gmail.com. You can also hit us up on Twitter at walking_theup. And as always, there is Facebook. We are at facebook.com/walkingtheunnamedpath. Let's see, we will be posting links to some of the stuff Sister Unity talked about on today's show and onto our Facebook page. So, you know, keep an eye out there. We'll also share a link to the Stone and Stang page so that you can. Sorry, I'm trying to get to the ending thing, and again, working with a Mac for the first time. But we will share the Stone and Stang page so that if you're interested in registering or even submitting after registration, submitting a workshop proposal, you know, feel free to do that. And we will try to get one of our brothers on the planning committee on as soon as possible. So again, thank you for listening to Walking the Unnamed Path, and we will see you in a couple of weeks. Have a blessed day.
You're listening to Pagans Tonight. Pagans unite on Pagans Tonight. Many paths, one network. For over 5 years, we've been the place to connect with the best, brightest, and most trusted voices in the pagan world. Every night is Pagans Tonight.